Hey.
Don't ever let somebody tell you you can't do something. Not even me. All right?
All right.
You got a dream, you got to protect it. People can't do something themselves. They want to tell you you can't do it. You want something, go get it. Period.
Some of the important aspects that are involved in making a good kitchen knife, the sort of thing that, you know, a chef will use for many years is proper heat treat of the steel and edge geometry. These are two pivotal key points that, you know, if you don't get it right, it's really not much of a knife. The steel has to be hard enough to retain an edge. And when it comes to edge geometry, it's not enough to put a sharp edge on a fat chunk of steel. The actual angles of the bevels, the primary bevels that'll ground in and how they relate to the rest of the knife is the difference between a high-performance chef's knife, a laser, as we call it, or, you know, just essentially a big chisel with a handle.
Hey guys, we'll get to the podcast in just a minute. However, I am looking for more great guests for the Blue Collar Voices show, and I am planning a road trip across America and including parts of Canada. I'll tell you more about both of these at the end of this podcast. Hey guys, welcome to the Blue Collar Voices show. Our guest today is Steve Pellegrino, and he is a knife maker. His specialty is creating cutlery, knives you use in the kitchen, making and preparing food. He has built up quite a name for himself in the cutlery world, and today we are going to delve into his journey. Steve, welcome to the Blue Collar Voices show.
Hi, John. Thank you for having me.
I am very happy to have you. Steve, I thank you for taking some time to be on the Blue Collar Voices show. I'm looking for all kinds of craftsmen, blue collar pros, tradespeople across different disciplines. And your particular niche is one that has fascinated me for years. I've watched a lot of YouTube videos of various kinds of craftsmanship of making of knives, even though I haven't made one myself. So to get started, tell us, what is your general focus day to day?
So day to day, I am producing both custom and partially machine made kitchen cutlery for chefs and home cooks alike. I've recently started doing production work, referring to the machine made part where I have water jet cut profiles and some other modern conveniences that reduce my labor and allow me to sell knives for a little bit less. As I'm sure anyone that's even dimly aware of the custom knife world, custom knives can be very expensive and often take a long time to make. So I'm shifting away from that a little bit so I can make tools for more people, essentially.
Okay. You gave me a lot of information there. When you started making your knives, how did you decide that cutlery is the area that you wanted to focus on?
I didn't jump into kitchen knives right away. I originally started, I was working in fabrication for many years, and I had my own shop, and I was more of a generalist. I made chairs, and I made stage infrastructure and things for theater and film and, you know, things of that nature. And I had seen someone make a knife out of an old file, and I thought, oh, that's kind of cool. You know, I thought I'd try it out. You know, knives, I think, are something that we all use and don't think about, and I was inherently interested in. You know, I've had many pocket knives, so I thought I'd just try to make one, see what it took, and I did nothing more than ruin the file. But it was a really interesting challenge. I was interested by how easily you could screw it up, essentially, and it's been an addicting challenge ever since. And so from there, I moved out to Portland, Oregon. I was looking for a bit of a change, and I moved out for an apprenticeship. Which is sort of where I began to get serious. And that was at Portland Razor Company in Portland, Oregon. And I worked with them for 3 months making straight razors for shaving. And so that's where I learned a lot about edge geometry and heat treat and, you know, what it takes to make something very sharp. And the biggest pivot there for me was the introduction of Japanese water stones, which is something I had no idea how to use. And so that was a good part of my training, just sharpening straight razors on those stones. just the principles of sharpness that I was then able to apply to kitchen cutlery later on. You know, I always say that I like to cook more than I like to shave, so it worked out well for me.
I'll be honest, I just have this cheap little thing that's got three different slots, coarse, medium, and fine. And I
sharpen
the knife. That's how I sharpen them. Let's assume that they were good quality steel.
Mm-hmm.
How much difference does it make in the application that you're talking about using, like the Japanese water stones and just getting an incredible edge on it versus just a decent edge? How much difference will you notice working with cutting up foods and vegetables and things like that?
I mean, it's a world of difference. The Japanese haven't been using them for thousands of years because they don't work that well. I feel like a lot of those pull-through sharpeners that you see, and to be fair, a lot of people have been misled over the years. You know, the last 20 years we've been marketed convenient sharpening, you know, how to get a sharp knife with doing the least amount of work possible. And I think that that's something that we've become more and more allergic to as a general population is work. And the pull-through sharpeners, from an engineering standpoint, you have two tool steel blades hidden inside of this case. And the idea is that you pull your knife through it, and that's going to cold push hardened steel out of the way and theoretically establish a new edge, which is very flawed. The idea and the reason why Japanese waterstones work so well is you have various grades of abrasive that are gently removing steel from the knife to establish a new edge, and it's doing it with a great deal of fidelity. You get a very fine edge. It's not stressing the steel. And when you work up through the grits, I mean, I could shave with my kitchen knives. I just feel that, you know, it is a superior way to sharpen. It takes a whole lot more work. It certainly, there's a learning curve to it. But if you put the time in, you can literally sharpen anything on a Japanese waterstone.
Very interesting. I'll have to check those out. You learned how to, at this apprenticeship, you learned a lot about making blades.
Mm-hmm.
Do you ever shave with a straight edge?
I have. To be fair, I don't actually shave that often. I just keep a beard and trim for the most of the time. You know,
right.
It's a very nice ritual that I would like to take part in more. It's just not something that I put the time into. You know, frankly, if I'm looking to shave, I'll go and do it the easy way. But there is a really pleasing ritual to it where you'll take a half an hour and stand there and you use the brush and you create a nice lather, and you know, you have to be very methodical about it.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, I see, you know, like videos or pictures, you got the old time barbers back in the day. They build everything up. They're, you know, they're stretching the skin. They're doing, the whole process is long. It takes a while to do a shave with a straight edge.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, my barber still uses a more modernized version of a straight razor that isn't a uniform piece of steel. It's they use safety razor inserts to a straight razor handle, but all the function is the same. It just essentially keeps it sanitary and prevents them from having to do sharpening.
Still dangerous.
Still dangerous. Anything that's sharp is dangerous, but a sharp knife is always a safer knife.
I remember as a kid, I did a lot of cutting with an axe, and I sharpened the axe up one time, and I had it so sharp I could actually shave the hairs on my arm. But when you have a nice sharp axe, you cut wood, it just goes in, it's so clean, it works so well. The same with knives. I just haven't delved into any knife making.
Yeah, it's exponentially more complicated if you want to be serious about it. You know, I mean, I always am an advocate of people trying it. You know, you can make yourself a paint can forge for $50 and go get a piece of carbon steel. It's very, low impact, low barrier for entry. You know, try it out and see how you feel about it. It's not that difficult to get into, but once you learn the principles and if you have the desire to improve, you can make it as complex as you like. And I know a lot of professionals that put an insane amount of time and energy into a very simple tool, myself included. And I really like a quote by Henry Royce, who, if you know Rolls-Royce, will be very clear who that is. That is, whatever is rightly done, however humble, is noble. And I think that there's a lot in there to unpack. I think that anything that we do in our lives, anything that we care about, Doing it well is worthwhile.
I agree. Yeah, that's true.
I think any craftsperson could.
I love craftsmanship. I love just, I told my brother the other day, I got on Instagram, I started looking at different people making different things. I said, dude, I could be so addicted just browsing all day long, looking at the phenomenal creations people have made.
Yeah.
There are some stunning craft people all over.
Yeah, it's true. You know, knife making in the United States is a relatively new construct. I'd say as old as perhaps the 70s, I think. The ABS, the American Bladesmith Society, is really our only Western standard for smithing. You know, that's not something I've gotten into yet, but in the future.
When you say smithing, you're talking about you haven't actually like got the steel and forged out a blank, turned it into a knife.
No, that is what I mean. Yeah. For, you know, essentially, if you say you're a bladesmith, I'd say generally you have forging experience. You can take a bar of steel, forge it out into a knife shape. Essentially, you have your profile. You can forge the bevels in, but there's a great deal of work that goes into it after that. A lot of the work I sell regularly is stock removal because forging takes a lot of time. It's a great deal of manual labor. For special customs, I'll do it, but generally I'll stick to stock removal if someone wants a knife that's a little bit more affordable.
So when you're doing the stock removal, you're ordering the steel. Does the steel come in the basic thickness that you need, or do you have to do a lot of removal as far as the thickness as well?
You can get stock these days in any alloy and any shape and size that you like. Generally, I'll order a bar of steel based on the project I may be working on, or perhaps a popular size, which would generally be between 3/32 and 1/8 inch thickness. The more steel that you have on the bar, the more you have to take off depending on what you're making. If I make a hunting knife, which I don't do all that often, you know, I'll have at least 3/16 thickness bar, but to make a chef's knife out of that would give you a lot more to remove. Yes.
The concept of making a knife for cutlery, for in the kitchen versus a hunting knife, is a different construction. What are the important aspects to kitchen knives? What is it that people are looking for?
Some of the important aspects that are involved in making a good kitchen knife, the sort of thing that, you know, a chef will use for many years, is proper heat treat of the steel and edge geometry. These are two pivotal key points that, you know, if you don't get it right, it's really not much of a knife. The steel has to be hard enough to retain an edge. And when it comes to edge geometry, it's not enough to put a sharp edge on a fat chunk of steel. The actual angles of the bevels, the primary bevels that'll ground in, and how they relate to the rest of the knife is the difference between a high-performance chef's knife, a laser, as we call it, or, you know, just essentially a big chisel with a handle.
You know, a lot of the knives, you know, there's this big, long bevel. But about halfway up, you know, you have the sharp edge and you have the blunt edge at the top. But about halfway in the middle there, it starts narrowing in. Got it like a more advanced angle, or sometimes it even seems like it's got a little bit of a concave surface. What is the purpose of that?
Well, insofar as chef's knives go, I would say that what you're referring to is either a hollow ground or an S grind, as it's called, which is where you have a very large radius platen, and you're grinding out that midsection so that there's less material behind the cutting edge. And so what this does is a number of things. It makes the actual cutting edge a lot thinner, and the material behind it reduces, that being gone, reduces friction and facilitates food release. That is, if you're cutting a potato and if you have thin slices, you'll notice that it's sticking to the blade. Food release is where that pops off very nicely and just lands on the cutting board.
And do you have customers that may request that it has it and other customers that request that it does not?
Generally, a lot of people don't know quite that much about the anatomy of knives. You know, they'll know what they want it to do, but they won't know what to ask for. So it's my job to bridge that gap and say, what are you using it for? What are you looking to get out of it performance-wise? et cetera, and so forth. And then what I'll do is design a knife based on that. They'll ask me why, and I'm happy to explain. But generally, I haven't met anyone that isn't a knife maker that knows what an S-grind is, for instance. But it's always task-specific. You know, there's a reason why there are so many different Japanese knives, different types of knives, because it generally you have one tool that does one job. It does it very well, and it doesn't really branch out so much. You wouldn't use a Gyoto, which is a Japanese chef's knife, to bone something because the edge is far too thin. The steel is very hard, and you would likely chip or break the knife in some way. You know, when you have something that's more of a French knife, the edge is a lot thicker, and it's sort of designed to be more of a lateral tool. You can bone things out with it, and you can use it for protein, and you can use it for veggies, and you can use it for herbs, whatever you like. A lot of times they had one knife or two, perhaps.
How long have you been making the knives now?
I've been making knives probably about 5 years total, and I've only been full-time for 2, going on 3.
When you first started making your knives and you started getting feedback, has the design of your knives changed based on feedback?
Yeah, drastically. Feedback from chefs, feedback from other makers. You know, I mean, early on, I would take the best knife I could possibly make and take it to someone who is a titan in the industry. Mareko Malmasi is one of these people. I brought one of my knives to him. And if anyone knows who he is, he's been making knives for over a decade at this point. He studied with Bob Kramer, which is the godfather of Western cutlery, custom kitchen knives, as far as I'm concerned, and many others as well. And, you know, he gave me a lot of really constructive feedback that I've implemented, and my knives have gotten a lot better since, I would say. And that was only a year and change ago. That he and I met for the first time.
Do you think that you've established a pretty good handle on the necessary design, or do you think that you'll change a little bit more in the future?
I've definitely gotten to a point where I can competently make a knife that I can guarantee what it will do, and I can guarantee that it will last a long time. I'll always be learning. I'm now selling knives, but they'll be improving every time. You know, my next knife is always going to be my best one. You know, I think that being a bladesmith, it kind of goes beyond the job title. This is a lifelong journey for me. I'm definitely a lifer. I've gotten to the point where I can't stop. I know I think about knives all the time. You know, while a career may demand, you know, that I make a certain amount of sales and I have a certain amount of products available, I'll be constantly improving the smallest details so that I can make a better tool ultimately.
I had one of my questions for you was, is this something you want to do forever? I think you've answered that just fine.
Yeah, it's, you know, it's a compulsion. It has to be, because any less than madness is not enough, frankly, because it demands an awful lot. And there's, you know, it's winter right now. Today is a very cold, gray day. You know, I work out of a one-car garage, and it's cold. Grinding is an unpleasant thing to do, standing on a cold concrete floor. You know, I'll stand at the grinder for hours on end with a stack of knives next to me that I have to get out. You know, it's not always easy.
You say a stack of knives, averaging it out. How many knives a day do you build?
It's never a complete build in a day. I batch out all my work, and at this point, I have enough orders and enough material that I'll take 10 knives through one process, and maybe I'll do a handful of jobs in a day. So at any given time, I'll have between, I would say, 10 to 25 knives in progress. Of that, you know, maybe several of them might get finished in a day, but they will have been worked on for weeks and weeks prior. So it sort of depends. There's a lot of different steps. You know, I'll heat treat anywhere from 3 to 6 knives at a time. And the heat treat process is something that you really can't put too many knives in at once, because thermally, you lose too much heat. You know, as you're taking one out and, you know, quenching it in the oil, and the next one might get too cold. So there's limitations there, but I try to be as efficient as possible without sacrificing quality.
Well, speaking of all the different steps, kind of break it down from start to finish what it is that you do.
Sure. If we're not counting forging, which is rather difficult to explain verbally, and also
that's a whole different process.
Yeah, it is. And it really has its roots in blacksmithing. And there's a lot of different things like isolating material and just the way hot steel moves under a hammer is very addicting, but also it takes a long time to control it with any competence. And I don't think I'm a very confident blacksmith at all. I can get the shape I need, but I, you know, there's many more efficient people out there that can move steel under a hammer than myself. If we're talking stock removal, which is probably 80% of what I do, I'll have a bar of steel that I either have water jet cut to the shape that I've designed, the profile of the knife. So whether it's a hidden tang or a full tang knife, that whole profile is essentially, I draw it by hand. Everything I do starts on paper. With water jet, I'll digitize it, or else I'm just cutting the profile out and grinding it by hand, which is much slower. From there, once I have a profile that's just essentially a 2D part, it's just a knife-shaped piece of steel, what I'll do is start grinding preheat treat bevels and also drill holes for pins in the handle into the tang. When I say preheat treat bevel, essentially I'm not taking the thickness of the edge all the way down to where it would be when it's sharpened and ready for use, because thermally the cross section is too thin. It's not very stable. So I leave it very thick so that we don't have warpage during heat treat. I'm just establishing the primary bevel. I'm establishing where it will be. And then from there, it goes into heat treat. Heat treat generally has a whole bunch of steps in and of itself. I normalize the steel, which only means that I'm taking it up to a certain temperature and taking it out of the oven and letting it cool to room temperature, or to black, as we say, which is probably still 800 degrees, but it's not glowing anymore. A critical temperature would be 1500 or 1600 degrees. You know, after normalizing, it's brought up to that same level of heat, about 1500 degrees. It's called austenite. Essentially, it's when the carbon within the steel goes into solution. Now, that's a tough concept for a lot of people to grasp, because, you know, you say, oh, well, steel is a solid, you know, material, but there is carbon within it. And thermally, when you take it up to that temperature where you could actually bend it very easily, it is closer to Play-Doh than it is to steel. You have the carbon within it that changes its molecular structure. And by quenching it into oil, you're freezing it in that state of suspension, essentially, the carbon within the steel. And you have a phase change. You're essentially taking, really? Yes, you're taking the old material that you had, which was austenitic steel, and you're quenching it to create martensite. Now, martensite is different entirely. It's still steel, but the structure is crystalline. It almost looks like a frozen lake, if you can imagine that. The best way to explain this concept is using an analogy of a creme brulee. You know, there's sugar on top, and you hit it with a torch, and that sugar kind of melts and becomes homogeneous. That's what happens to the carbon. And so this crystalline structure, this martensite, is the basis of a really good knife. It's extremely hard, but it does have a flaw. It's also extremely brittle. So what we do at that point is then temper it back at a low temperature. This could be around 400 degrees. What you're doing is removing a small amount of hardness, but we're gaining a lot of ductility. We're making it a tougher tool, so it won't chip as readily. I mean, if you dropped an untempered knife on the floor, it could break like glass. It's that hard. The tempering makes it a much more useful tool, and the degree to which you temper it depends on the job. I temper my chef's knives less than I would a hunting knife, for instance, because they're made to do a lot more tough work. With a hunting knife, you never know what kind of circumstance it may encounter. It may need to save someone's life. You know, you don't want it breaking at that moment. So that's the heat treat process. And then after that, it's all finish grinding. So essentially, I'm taking fresh abrasives, keeping the blade very cool so as not to ruin the heat treat. And I'm grinding it, and I'm thinning out the bevels and sort of dialing in that geometry I was talking about earlier. And at the same time, I'm refining the scratch pattern. So that is the marks I'm making. The abrasive is cutting steel away. I want to do that as neatly as possible to make it more attractive. And so I'll work my way up through the grits, and then depending on the knife or the finish I'm going for, sometimes I'll either use a Scotch-Brite belt to finish it, or I'll hand sand it with abrasives. And the hand sanding is a very time-consuming process. It could take many more hours on top of that.
Now, does the hand sanding, is it used to maybe not quite polish it out, but get rid of the mark so it's just kind of like a matte finish for the steel?
Yeah, basically. That's exactly right. You know, if I've done a Hanyaki heat treat, which refers to using like a santonite clay on the blade, which creates a differential heat treat line, also known as a hamon, the polishing is necessary to bring that out, and then we'll dip it in acid to sort of accentuate it. That's not dissimilar from the way katanas were made.
Okay.
And then from there, it's a matter of mounting a handle. You know, I use a variety of exotic woods and stabilized woods and composites like micarta. I recommend micarta because it's practically indestructible. Back when it was invented, it was the steel of the plastics industry. And it, you know, it used to be used for countertops and all sorts of things that we, you know, needed to resist moisture and impact and things like that. So they make great handles.
Is that related to what they call formica?
Perhaps. I suspect they were both made by DuPont, you know, different composites that were essentially used to replace wood because wood requires maintenance. You know, there we are again, remove maintenance, remove a little bit of work, remove chores, right, from our daily lives. Wood needs to be cared for. It needs to be oiled periodically, just like a cutting board does. So I suspect, you know, just like Bakelite, you know, these were new composites that were used to replace wood in all of these applications.
So what kind of maintenance is necessary for the knives?
Provided that you're using a carbon steel knife with a wood handle, the handle likes a little bit of oil from time to time. They tend to dry out over years of use. If it's a carbon steel blade, you need to wipe it as you're using it because acidic ingredients will cause it to develop a patina, which is just a very light level of oxide that happens. You know, the higher the acid content, like if you're cutting a lemon, especially on a high carbon steel, you'll get a very drastic darkening of the steel in the areas where it was in contact with the juice. You know, some people like that less than others, so I do offer stainless as well. You know, but all steel needs to be cared for. They call it stainless, not stain never. You still have to keep it dry and lightly oiled periodically. That goes across the board for almost any metal cutting tool. But other than that, you know, they're pretty simple, robust tools. It's when you start to use fancier materials and different things like that that they require a little extra care to keep them looking good for a long time. But I ship all of my knives with a lifetime guarantee for non-commercial applications. You know, if you have one of my knives at home and something happens that perhaps it wasn't your fault, or you just, you know, the handle's never going to pop off is what I'm saying. You know, I use all the best materials I can and the best processes I know how to execute.
You talked about the grinding earlier, and you're talking about keeping it cool. What type of grinding? I can imagine a belt, but do you actually have like a really wide grinding, rotational grinding stone that you use?
It's actually not wide at all. It's only a 2-inch belt, but the circumference is 72 inches. So you get a lot of abrasive in a very small contact patch. You know, they're essentially designed for knife makers, occasionally called a linisher, generally called a belt grinder. You know, 2x72 is a popular size, and mine has a variable speed control, as many of them do, which just helps gain more control over the amount of material and how you're removing it. But it's a ceramic abrasive belt. Some of the best are made by Combat Abrasives out of California. You know, ceramic is necessary because you need something harder than the steel you've just hardened to remove it efficiently and reduce the amount of heat friction that's built up, because the heat friction can actually ruin your heat treat. If you begin to see colors coming through, you maybe anyone that's ever used an angle grinder to cut into a piece of steel, if they really push into it hard, you can start to see heat differential colors coming out from the point where from the heat affected zone. You know, that's stress going into the steel. And if you have a knife that's a very thin cross section of this very very finicky, I'll say, martensite, you know, it doesn't like temperature. If you heat it up too much, you've ruined it.
There's a lot of details that are all in play. Everything has an impact.
Yes. And I've made the mistake of doing each one of them wrong before I learned how to do it right. You know, I've made a lot of bad knives before I can make a good one.
Sure. With the grinder or the belt that you're using to grind with, you talked about it not getting too hot. So that means you probably got to run that belt slow.
Sometimes I'll run it at a fairly high speed. The key to keeping the knife cool is to be constantly dipping it in water.
Okay.
So I have a bucket of water underneath the grinder, and a lot of us do. It's pretty standard in the industry to have a bucket of water to both catch your sparks, to extinguish them immediately, and also to constantly be dipping your knife to keep it cool. It's not uncommon for steam to be coming off the knife as I'm dipping it and continue grinding, you know, just to sort of keep it below that critical temperature where you start to get heat damage. Yeah,
it's hot, but in
but you know, I mean, it's
go ahead.
You're right. It's hot to the touch, but metallurgically, you know, 100 degrees won't hurt it.
Okay.
Yeah.
So you talked about the fact that you did a lot of creation before you started with your knives. Just tell us a little bit about what you did before you actually started with the knives. Short version.
Well, I studied graphic design at the School of Visual Arts in Manhattan. I quickly became disenfranchised with the industry and what they expected of us, the craftspeople. It's all computerized. I essentially learned the early days of graphic design when things were still done by hand. I think more and more as I went through school, I realized that was not the way, and I pushed away from it and sort of followed a path where I could, you know, still use tools and still build things and get my hands dirty. I don't like computers, especially for designing, because it feels like my hands are cut off, and it's, you know, you have a disconnect between what it is you're making. So as I graduated school, I got into fabrication. I wasn't lucky enough to have my tab paid for me. So I have student loans, and I had to figure out some way to do it. So I was working in fabrication to finance school while I was there. And also afterwards, I opened up a shop and I did, you know, hard edge fabrication. I did woodworking. I did welding. I did all that stuff. And, once I decided to get into knives, it was a slow start, because it's really hard to make money at it when you're still learning how to just do it properly. So I worked many other jobs in the meantime. You know, I also tended bar while I was in school, you know, whatever it takes.
Well, when you had your shop, was that a viable, like, if you did not have your passion for knives, is that the type of place that you would have just been happy just to create inside that shop?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it was my own business. You know, I don't do well working for others. I've tried many times. I'd like to be making my own decisions, and I'd rather fail by my own ideas than make a meager wage by somebody else's. I was able to delve into a lot of different disciplines, and I was able to complete client jobs at the same time. So it was, you know, education on the job. I absolutely would have continued that, and I'll end up back there if knives don't work out as well as they are now. You know, I have a great deal of interest these days in machining. You know, I look to the future. I want to get a metal lathe. I want to get a Bridgeport mill. You know, I think that these are the tools that originally built this country, and with any luck, we can do it again.
So if you get those particular components, that equipment, what is it you would build with those, like a lathe? What is it you're wanting to make?
I mean, any component you can imagine, you know, with some machining skill, a lathe and a mill, you can make any part for anything that broke. You know, I love to fix my own things. I really don't like relying on someone else to do it or just buying a new one. You know, the throwaway culture that we have now is upsetting to me. Mm-hmm. You know, I think we've lost these skills that once upon a time, if you wanted a chair, you had to build it, because that's where you got chairs. Like, there was no store to get chairs from. And I realize that's a very drastic, you know, I'm not a Luddite. That's obviously, we'll never be back at that point. But I think that there's something to be learned from trying.
Sure.
And there's something to be appreciated from, you know, what it once took to have these things, and throwing them away was unthinkable. You know, I get in on these rants, and I've forgotten the question. I apologize.
Well, the rants are always welcome. I appreciate rants. The fact is, what I'm hearing is that you are way more. It's the knife making is something that's a niche for you that you're passionate about, but you're a craftsman through and through. I mean, it's just the essence of you. It's the ethos. It's the way you look at the world, and that's awesome. I think that creating and making and doing is fantastic. Obviously, you have to have the equipment to do it, but like getting that lathe and it's something you can make, or it's just something you can create. So when you're not making knives,
yes, that's what it was.
You're still creating other things.
You know, a lathe and a mill are the only two tools that can create themselves, which was a fact that when I learned it, it really kind of blew my mind. You know, if civilization fell, we could rebuild it with those two tools, because they, you know, you can make literally anything. And I just love that. Anything that breaks, I can make a new part for. And I think that that's ultimately where I'd like to land, you know, in my life.
My brother has, it's very rudimentary, but he has a metal lathe. He has a mill. He has a couple different welders, and, you know, he's a maker and a builder. Mm. He lives in a small community in Kentucky, but one of these Amish guys will show up. They're like, they need this thing, and he'll fabricate something for them that replaces the part. Sometimes he adds a little touch that makes it a little bit better, but he gets on his mill. He's like, okay, he has stock. Mm-hmm. He's able to adjust the stock. He welds, and he's creating parts. He's making things. And that sounds exactly like what you're talking about. Is just, it doesn't matter. Now, obviously there's some things that's going to require more, like it's going to may require a little bit more work if you wanted to build, say, a crankshaft, but it's not out of the realm of what you could do.
Oh, of course. It's certainly possible. I'm only limited by my own. Yeah. I'm only limited by my own knowledge. Right.
Absolutely. And oh, I remember the other part, because you're talking about, like, you know, if shit hits the fan or things collapse, you still have the skills to do what you need to do.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, and, you know, I'm not a doomsdayer. I don't want that to happen, but I think that, there's too many people that are unprepared.
How much is it that people get themselves into little slots? Like, I am a, and I'm gonna throw different things, like I'm an accountant, or I'm a driver, or I'm a whatever. And they have other interests, but they just don't even explore. They just stay in their lane.
Yeah.
And that's the way they live life.
You know, and it's, I don't even hold it against them, because I understand the need to make money to survive. You know, I'm not a trust fund baby. I can't just dip into a bottomless account anytime I need something. You know, you have to work for it, and it's not always going to be work that you like. You know, I've met plenty of accountants and lawyers that used to be chefs, and they really enjoy it, but, oh, you know, this makes more. Mm-hmm. It's the society we live in now. And I think that it's possible to break free of that, but it's not going to be easy, and it you'll have to make sacrifices, and I've sacrificed a lot.
There are people that have taken a different turn, and they've changed the trajectory of their life, and now they're maybe making just a tenth of what they used to make, but they're happy.
Exactly. And how do you put a price on that?
It's pretty important.
Yeah.
So, you know, you have your knives and you're making knives. How much of it is the success that you're able to produce these knives and sell these knives? How much of it is the fact that you've established a brand? People know your brand and they want a knife from you just because they trust it and they like it.
I think it's important. It's 20% of it is what it looks like, but 80% of it is getting your work out there and having people say, oh, you know, this is actually a good knife. Like, I like this. You know, they'll tell their friend and then they buy one and then somebody else sees that. And that's the, it takes time, but it snowballs. And I think that's really just how I've done it. It's no trick. I just kept doing it and tried to get better every time. And, you know, eventually it takes a little bit of luck. Someone sees it that knows a lot of people that'll really want a knife, you know, and oftentimes I get commissions via other commissions, and, you know, it snowballs. I think building a brand is something that's elusive and it's difficult. You know, I have an eye for design. I studied graphic design so I could brand myself. But I understand that, you know, maybe not everyone is perhaps as naturally artistic. So, you know, I think that being honest and being upfront and making something that you stand behind is the best way to get started.
And so we have the advent of the internet, we have social media. How much of this availability do you attribute to your success?
Oh, almost all of it. Instagram was invaluable in just getting my work in front of people when I, in, you know, my immediate circle had no one to show. You know, I didn't know any chefs before when I started making chef's knives. When you put them online, you know, there's a community of other people doing the same thing. And so you have this pool of knowledge, and people who might be looking for one will go there, and they'll just, maybe something about the knife that I made resonates differently with them than something that, you know, I could, another maker doing it just as long, just as, you know, skilled, the knife is probably just as good, but something about the way it hits their eye, that's really the first impression. You know, I think having a background in design has given me sort of a backdoor into knife making, because it allowed me to look at the form and say, well, this just doesn't feel right. You know, maybe I'll try this. You know, I mean, early on, I would make knives once for myself just to see how they worked and see how they felt, because you can draw knives all day long, but until you cut one out and it exists in steel and you feel how it actually cuts and how it performs, you know, that's the acid test for any tool, really.
Mm-hmm. And if those little details.
Oh, yeah. Just to get back to Instagram and the internet, you know, that this is something that we have now that no one's ever had before. So I'd say it's easier than ever to, if you are making something, to get it in front of people and to get feedback. And that's that sort of feedback that helps you grow.
It allows you to reach so many people, but also you now have that competition. You know, you're not the local knife maker. Anybody can order a knife from anywhere in the world.
Yeah, that's true. But also, I feel like there isn't a ton of competition within the field, because there are only so many of us. And you have culinary schools around the country that are turning kids out every year, and everybody needs knives, mm-hmm. not just culinary students either. So I feel like if you have something that's original, and you know, if you can get it in front of the right audience, I don't think any of us are taking food out of each other's mouths, so to speak, you know.
You touched a little bit about the fact that you wanted to get some additional equipment, but what other projects, ideas, or goals do you have?
You know, sure, I have short-term goals. I plan on building some infrastructure over the holiday break that will improve the quality of my work and improve my efficiency. You know, every time I either buy or build a new machine, it makes the work even better. Short-term, that's really what I'm looking at. Long-term, I'd like to expand my line of products. I'd like to have more knives available for purchase right away, so that someone doesn't have to wait 4 or 5 months for me to make it from scratch. You know, I'll still offer that, but probably on a smaller basis. You know, the one thing I want out of my career is to have the freedom, you know, to have a business that runs well, so I have the freedom to pursue crazier ideas, to make my own steel, you know, in the shop. Home, you know, shop crucible steel is something that's very interesting to me. You know, liberating iron ore from the earth and turning that into steel that then I make a knife from. You know, that's where I'd like to be in the future. Bob Kramer, who I mentioned earlier, makes knives out of meteorites, and he can create pattern welded steel, you know, with meteorite in it. And that's just fascinating to me. I mean, I always grew up being kind of a science geek, and, you know, to think of stardust being used to create a tool that you use every day is kind of magic. And I don't know anybody else that does it other than him. You know, I think that, you know, freedom to be creative within the constraints of a simple tool like a knife is, you know, where I'd like to be. And I think I'd be most happy doing that.
Have you ever had any apprentices?
No, I haven't. To be honest, I don't feel like I should right now. This is a personal limitation. No one has ever told me that I shouldn't or shouldn't. You know, I sort of have respect for the idea that this is a journey for me, and I will always be better the next year than the year before. And I'm at a point right now where I'm growing more rapidly, but I don't think I'm ready to be teaching someone, you know, the finer points of knife making. I do teach. I have classes, and, you know, if I would never take on an apprentice and have them believe that what I'm saying is law. Mm-hmm. You know, I would say that I would happily point them in the direction of other resources, and I'd tell them what works for me personally. But, you know, I'm no master. You know, I think that it's humbling to pursue something that you may never achieve. And I think that if I could give an apprentice anything, it would be that philosophy.
Steve, I really appreciate you coming on and sharing about what you're doing with your knives.
Thank you, John. My pleasure.
Absolutely. I didn't dig into what you were doing too deep, because I wanted to ask the questions and be as surprised as the audience when I ask. I really like to know basically a minimal amount and then go in and ask questions.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
I thank you for sharing what you've got going on. I wish you great success on your journey, and we'll definitely talk again. Also, go ahead and tell how people can contact you.
Sure. My website is PellegrinoCutlery.com. I'm Pellegrino_Cutlery on Instagram. And, I put almost daily updates on Instagram. I sort of am intermittent with my posts just because I just don't like to flood people. And I'm also busy. But I put what I'm working on up in the stories and I post stuff. And the website is where you can see some more of my work and buy things and all the rest of it. You know, I'm working on a new economy line model, which will be a more affordable knife made with the same quality materials that'll be coming out next year in 2020. So I've got a lot going on. There's a lot more on the horizon.
Sounds great. Looking forward to keeping up with it. I'll add these links to your stuff in the show notes. Steve, I wish you well. I'll talk to you soon.
Thanks so much, John. Take care.
Hey, guys, before you go, two things. The first is, I'm looking for more great guests for the Blue Collar Voices show. Basically, I'm looking for those that excel in the blue collar arena and have actually got their hands dirty, truly understanding what it is like to do the work. Now, the second thing, and exciting, hey, at least for me, I am planning a road trip. Phase one is building a list of locations to visit. Some locations will be just a meet and greet. Others will be on-site audio and or video. Please check out the website for more information. I'd love to hear from you. Email me at johnc@bluecollarvoices.com. You can also hit me up on LinkedIn. Thanks all. Looking forward to hearing from you. Blue Collar Voices is produced by John Chapman, and all audio, video, graphics are created and edited by John Chapman. Blue Collar Voices is a DR7 Media production.
I'll be back.